dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Our program this week deals with U.S. foreign policy and the so-called war on terrorism. To speak of a war on terrorism suggests that terrorism is a special act that is carried out by special people, terrorists. But terrorists, like guerrillas or official soldiers of a nation-state, are really a diverse collection of people driven into acts of politically based mass killing by some form of necessity, whether a necessity they themselves feel or a necessity determined by a government which orders them to arms. In the present world, there are numerous peoples in states of oppression by others, yet not all resort to terrorism to make themselves heard. The reasons for this are no doubt very complex, but among those reasons, I think, must be the extent to which the dominating group is viewed as inhuman, uncaring, and lacking in basic decency. We as a people see ourselves as decent and caring. We ought to ask what makes others see us differently. And if we want to be honest, we ought to ask how decent and caring we are as a society when politicians are able to gain elected office by promising to withdraw aid to poor people within our own society, and who respond to social problems with a perennial parade of police and prisons, failing to acknowledge the hateful and degrading life circumstances and options presented to so many of our own, while others in this society engage in greed as if it were a great virtue. Almost everyone who addresses the attack of 9/11, no matter what their political perspective, condemns the massive loss of civilian life as a crime against humanity. The notion of a war crime suggests that there is an alternative way to conduct war which does not target civilians and is therefore not a crime. This seems based on a method of warfare that is becoming extinct. Two armies facing each other on a battlefield where non-combatants are absent. I think that once bombing became a fixture of warfare, mass deaths of non-combatants has become the rule. If one accepts that the bombing of civilians on 9/11 is terrorism and a crime against humanity, then for consistency's sake, it seems one must also condemn as such the so-called war on terrorism as carried out against Afghanistan. As well, one must regard as a crime against humanity the present Israeli military assault against the Palestinians, not just the suicide bombing of Israelis by Palestinians. Or to put it another way, war without war crimes has ceased to exist, as if it ever did, though only those who lose wars face prosecution. Peacemakers from all over the globe are converging in Palestine to deliver humanitarian assistance and serve as human shields as part of an international solidarity effort to protect Palestinian civilians under attack by the Israeli military. Two women from Ithaca, Audrey Stewart and Grace Ritter, are among those peacemakers. Last Friday, the two gave a report by phone on what they had been seeing to Ken Ritter and Linda Holzbauer, Grace's parents.
So we arrived in Bethlehem, and there was a truckload of food that had somehow gotten in. We unloaded it into a warehouse. This is during the curfew, so nobody, it's like a ghost town that's normally, you know, throngs of people. It's just dead. And, you know, we could hear shooting and even a couple warning shots in our direction just for being outside. But we did get the food unloaded. We were then sort of took a little walk through Bethlehem, again in violation of the curfew, but with press people on a big white flag. We got as close as we could to Manger Square, and then we returned back by soldiers with, you know, their guns drawn. at first they seemed really hostile, but then we were able to talk to one or two. I mean, I don't have any illusions they talked to us. If we did something they didn't want, they would probably still shoot at us. Then we walked back. Then we made this plan to try to walk to the refugee camp in Dehesha. A lot of the worst conditions right now are in the refugee camp because people are really isolated, and that's also where most of the resistance has come out of, is the refugee camps. People are really, really desperate and just sort of beaten into submission and also, you know, hatred by the conditions there. So we decided to walk in, or attempt to walk into Tahitia. It's about a 30-minute walk from where we were in Bethlehem, and that's on a really open road. So we were exposed to snipers, but we also felt, from talking to people, pretty sure that a group of internationals with, you know, big white flag would probably be okay. We started walking, and there wasn't any, previously when we had gone out in other towns against the curfew, we had had warning shots fired at us, but that didn't happen this time. And we walked pretty far. We could start to be able to see Dehesha. It's about, I think, 3/4 of a mile from the Star Hotel to Dehesha, but we probably got half of, we were probably an 1/8 to 1/4 of a mile away from Dehesha. We could see, like, the shells just bombed out buildings. And we heard probably 15 minutes. By that point, we had been hearing machine gun fire and tank fire getting louder and louder. And probably for 15 minutes, pretty sustained, you know, and not stopping. As we got closer, we started to feel a little concerned about our own safety because of the sustained gunfire getting louder and louder. And then, just as we were trying to decide what to do, a shot was fired in our direction. Just a warning shot. It didn't come that close to us, but it was enough to make us stop. We then, you know, held our hands up, hoping that they could see us, and pretty soon, two tanks came, zooming our, an APC and a tank came zooming our way with, you know, their guns. You know, you can't see anyone in them, just the tank barrel and then the guns on top. Then they stopped, one beside us and one in front of us. The one aimed its barrel at us, and the guns were aimed at us, and we just stood there for about 5 minutes, kind of ironically, next to a big sign for the Palestinian Conflict Resolution and Peaceful Solutions Center. And then finally someone emerged from the tank, or the APC, and sort of looked out and called one of us over, said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "We're going to Dehesha to take pictures and give candy to the children." He said, you can't do that. And Ben said, did we want an escort from him so we didn't get shot by snipers? And we said, no thanks. But he escorted us anyway. You know, and as we walked with him, two sniper shots were fired in our direction, but not that close. We think they didn't, you know, probably wouldn't have shot at us if they'd seen the tank or the APC, but they didn't see it, obviously. We walked, you know, slowly. We finally made it back to our, the place where we were staying, the Star Hotel. And then we just used the rest pretty late by then. And breaking the curfew is always dangerous, but especially after 4 o'clock. So we just kind of stayed inside after that. This morning, we got up and we delivered food as far as we could go. Because the families, the closer you get to Manger Square, the more isolated the families are, and the more severe the curfew is. So we delivered as much food as we could carry, and we got almost, you know, just not far off from being able to see the Nativity Church. And we turned back because we ran out of food, and we were stopped by soldiers on our way back. So we came back with another load of food, but we weren't allowed to get in with it.
You keep talking about snipers. Who are the snipers, Audrey?
They're the Israeli Defense Forces snipers. Right. When the Israeli Defense Force takes over a town like they've done in, you know, Ramallah, Bethlehem, all over the West Bank, what they do is they first roll in with their tanks and APCs and just decimate the infrastructure. You know, we saw apartment buildings in both Jenin and Bethlehem, apartment buildings where people had been sleeping shot right into. Today we saw someone collected a missile. A missile was shot into their apartment, and it has a U.S., made in U.S. thing on it.
Yeah.
They go and take over all the tall buildings. If it's an apartment building, they cram the people into one room. of the apartment building, and they take over the rest of the building, and they station themselves on the top floors or on the roof of the tall building, and then they just shoot at anything that moves out in the street. You know, now they're getting a little smarter but about not shooting at Americans or journalists, but, you know, they shoot like a young Palestinian boy who was retarded and deaf, ran out of his house for a second, and he's dead. They shot him with her three children right in the room, dead. So they do that, and just keeps people cowering in their houses. Then they also, you know, the tanks rumble around, and the APCs rumble around on patrol, and the streets are very narrow there. So as they go through, these, you know, Israeli tanks just take out whatever isn't, you know, if a building's in their way, they just rip the side off of it. Power lines, water lines cut in Bethlehem, close to the main street there. Does that answer your question?
Yes. You're in East Jerusalem now?
We're in East Jerusalem. That's Palestinian controlled Jerusalem.
And what are your plans for tomorrow?
Well, we've heard that there's a major demonstration in Jenin mixed Israeli peace activists, Jewish Israeli peace activists, Palestinians who live inside, you know, not in the occupied territories, Palestinian peace activists and international. So it's going to the around the West Bank, staying in Israel, going around the West Bank to the Israeli checkpoint rather than the, you know, the Palestine checkpoint.
So this will be in Israel tomorrow, all over the place?
What?
Will this be all over? Or in one location? I'm sorry. Tell me the location again.
We're going to drive through Israel to Jenin.
Uh-huh.
You can get to Jenin or to just outside of Jenin, either going through Israel or going through Palestine.
Okay.
You know, through the occupied West Bank. So we're going to, since it seems like people are not getting in from the Palestinian side, we're going to go from the Israeli side. And if this is unclear, you can look at a map, and it makes it really clear. Do a demonstration outside that checkpoint with food and medicine for people inside. Seems like that has good possibilities because it incorporates Israelis, especially Jewish Israelis. And that's where some of the worst destruction and where the worst carnage is from. So...
Well, thank you very much.
Yep.
We'll put this report out as far as we can.
Okay.
And that was Audrey Stewart.
Yep.
Reporting from Palestine on Friday, the 12th. Is Grace available?
She is. Just a second.
Okay.
Okay.
Hello?
Hi, Grace.
How are you doing?
Audrey gave us an update of what you did in Bethlehem and what you did today. So just some more perspectives from your point of view would be helpful. She told us that you were unloading food and you've traveled to East Jerusalem. And what are you doing today for the rest of the day?
Right now it's sort of just a downtime before we head to Jenin tomorrow. We're going to be going with large groups of Israeli peace activists from a lot of different cities. There's different buses going. So we might be traveling with the Women in Black from Jerusalem, or we might meet up with people in Tel Aviv and travel with them. We have to travel way up and around the West Bank because we're traveling on Israeli roads. And this same group of activists last week had a demonstration at Ramallah to get food in there, and they were beaten and tear gassed for a long time, but they kept holding out until four trucks got into Ramallah with food. So hopefully something can come of this, because the situation in Jenin is so horrible, and it's really isolated as well. Really hopeful that the Israeli peace activists are paying attention to that right now.
Has the fighting decreased at all with the arrival of Secretary of State Powell, from your perspective?
As far as I know, we had a little bit of at the Bethlehem Star Hotel. And this morning we saw a little bit of a press conference with Powell and Sharon, and Powell said, we've exchanged views, and we hope to exchange more views in the next few days, and that was it. So I haven't heard of any fighting, ceasing, or anything like that. It's possible, but I haven't heard of anything. I was sort of freaked out about going to Jenin tomorrow, but we drove out of Bethlehem with some Palestinians, a young Palestinian who works with a peace organization over here in Jerusalem, and she was just telling us, giving us stories of the different things that she's witnessed and the humiliation that happens to her every day and everybody around her. And she always sticks up for herself, and that she's been beaten because of it and held at gunpoint and all of that. And then we were held at the checkpoint for a long time, not as long as other Palestinian men who were standing there for hours, but, you know, for a considerable time. And just seeing that has made me feel differently about going up there, that I need to do it. And
you'll be with a lot of Israeli peace activists tomorrow.
Yeah, the demonstration that happened at Ramallah was 3,000. So hopefully there'll be that many there too. I mean, the refugee camps are so reminiscent of concentration camps, and the checkpoints and identification and the humiliation, and just the way, you know, this young woman was telling us how they talk to her and, you know, what they can say to her and what just humiliate her forever, and they can do that. Anyway.
I understand. I mean, Audrey said they were shooting missiles into apartments.
Yeah, we got pictures of that.
Right.
You know?
Right.
But even in Bethlehem today, when they lifted the curfew for a little while, they were still shooting people, and there was still gunfire, and
who was
they? You know, killed somebody.
The Israelis?
Yeah.
When you use the word sniper, say who the sniper was, because people in the newspapers here, it keeps talking about gun battles. So snipers,
no,
people don't know what that
not
means.
Happening.
Gun battles are not happening?
Not where we've been.
Okay.
Last night we were talking to a lot of Palestinian journalists who were staying in the hotel, and they were saying, you know, there's no way that people inside the church have any kind of ammunition left, they think. They might be throwing stones or something. And then we talked to an Israeli soldier today when we were stopped, and he was like, oh, yeah, they're shooting back at us. So there's that. But when I say sniper, it always means an Israeli sniper.
Well, thank you, Grace.
Yeah.
And we'll speak to you later.
Okay.
Okay?
Okay.
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 We love you.
We love you. I'll talk to you later. Okay, bye.
That was Audrey Stewart and Grace Ritter speaking last Friday with Grace's parents, Ken Ritter and Linda Holtzbauer. For the remainder of the show, you'll hear a forum that was held recently in Auburn as part of a series of public dialogues in the wake of 9/11. The actual event included a lengthy question and answer session, which we have edited due to our time constraints.
The purpose of the Community Dialogue series is to foster genuine and searching discussion at the local level of America's place in the world. Today's topic is U.S. foreign policy and the war on terrorism. Our moderator today is Matthew Spina, editor of Auburn's newspaper, The Citizen. One of the basic and permanent key values of the Green Party is grassroots democracy. Thinking people are all more than a little bit fed up with sound bites and insults taking the place of quality political discussion. The American public deserves better than that. Our understanding of the issues of the day will be richer in proportion to the careful listening and insightful questioning that we all do here today. This is a free speech area in a free speech nation, and we are proud to claim our place in that heritage. Thank you very much.
We'll start with Kevin Dunn. Kevin Dunn is an assistant professor of political science at Hobart and William Smith Colleges. He teaches courses in international relations, American foreign policy, and African politics. He has published several articles and chapters on African politics, African international relations, and U.S. relations toward Africa. His regional focus is on the African Great Lakes region, Congo, Uganda, Rwanda, Burundi, and Tanzania. His recent co-edited book, Africa's Challenge to International Relations Theory, was published by Palgrave Press. The professional journal Foreign Affairs, in reviewing the book, called it a valuable contribution to current debates on the rapidly changing world order. Dr. Dunn's main interests concern issues of development and North-South relations, particularly U.S. policies toward the Third World. He originally hails from the southern United States and received his Ph.D. from Boston University. Since September 11th, he has had several op-ed pieces published in regional papers and has given public talks on the terrorist attack and the U.S. response to various audiences from Geneva, New York, to Mbarara, Uganda. Dr. Dunn.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you all for coming, and thank you for the invitation to speak today. When I was invited, I was asked to give somewhat of a neutral view or of a kind of a framing discussion about U.S. foreign policy and how the current war against terrorism, the war in Afghanistan, fits into this history of international relations and U.S. foreign policy. So I'll do my best to situate it in that. I don't believe in neutrality. I believe everyone has an agenda, so obviously mine will probably become readily apparent. But I'll do my best to confuse you. U.S. foreign policy, as in any country's foreign policy, is generally regarded as promoting and protecting the national interest, which is a very simple observation. The question starts to bog down as to what is our national interest. And the famous 20th century political theorist Hans J. Morgenthau pointed out that national interest, it's an empty vessel just waiting to be filled by political leaders, media elite, or the citizenry. So the question that we have to ask ourselves is, how has the national interest of the United States been defined for the last 50-odd years? The basic point I want to make is that since 1945, the end of World War II, the United States' guiding national interest has been the protection and promotion of the international system, right, is the status quo. And this is the overarching logic of U.S. foreign policy. The United States is not motivated externally by the principles and beliefs that guide it domestically. Now, internally, we are a democracy that values civil liberties, freedom, and so forth. This is not how we act externally. And I think we've always been clear, at least the foreign policymakers have always been very clear about that. You might hear some rhetoric about the spreading of democracy, but the U.S. is not interested in establishing international organizations that are completely democratic because that might infringe upon our own sovereignty. Nor are we interested in pursuing liberty and freedom that might go against our national interests as we define them. So I just want to make that first point, that how we live domestically is not how we live externally. I think U.S. foreign policy speakers and authors have always been very clear about that. We need to recognize that as the U.S. national interest has been defined in terms of promoting and protecting the international system, and we're talking about the international system, we're talking about the political and the economic system, we need to recognize that this is a fairly new creation. Right? We take it as granted that there are sovereign, autonomous, territorially defined states that make up the international system. This is not the way the world has always been. In fact, this is a fairly new creation. The roots are in the Treaty of Westphalia from 1648 that ended the 30 Years' War in Northern Europe, which made the notions of sovereignty, autonomy, and territoriality the guiding principles of how Europe was going to organize itself politically. Now, at the same time, various forms of capitalism emerged to be the dominant ways that Northern Europe was going to practice its economic policies. So what you see in the 17th and 18th century is this emergence of a European political and economic system, which is very distinct, right? What happens in the 17th, 18th, and 19th century is that political and economic system in Northern Europe starts to spread out and eventually to take over the entire globe. How it does that is through European imperialism and colonialism. Europeans go out, colonize the world, Africa, the Americas, Asia, and basically create a world in its own image, dividing up Africa, Asia, literally in the case of Africa, dividing it up at a conference in Berlin, drawing lines on the map, dividing up the space and various autonomous territorial entities, guiding by the notion of sovereignty, with a clear understanding of certain economic modes of production and so forth, so that this, what was a Northern European political and economic system in the late 17th century, by the 20th century, is a global system. And it's spread out by European imperialism. And in fact, for the most part, the stability of the international, as it's now become, economic and political system is maintained by European imperialism. The European empires are what give it stability and coherence. There's a problem in 1945. European empires are pretty much decimated because they've destroyed themselves back home in Europe. What happens post-1945 is the United States becomes the guiding force in the promotion and protection of this international system. And it does this in various ways. End of World War II, it recognizes that European empires are collapsing. In order to provide stability to the political system, it engages in creating various international organizations, namely the United Nations. Economically, it tries to establish stability, again through international organizations. At a meeting at Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, where we refer to this as the Bretton Woods economic system, the U.S. invites Britain, other various world leaders, economic interest, to chart out the new economic world order, creating organizations like the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the International Trade Organization, which eventually will evolve into the World Trade Organization. These international organizations are there to give stability and coherence to the economic system, just as the United Nations is to give coherence to the political system. Under all of this is U.S. power, U.S. Hegemony, U.S. military power, U.S. economic power. The Bretton Woods economic system is clearly linked to U.S. Economic hegemony. In fact, it's tied to the strength of the U.S. dollar. What emerges in 1945, or soon after 1945, is that the United States is an imperial power. I'll be very clear about this. The United States is an imperial power. We can talk about it in terms of superpower or a hegemon, but what we're really talking about is the fact that the United States is an imperial power. Now the question is, where's its empire? Right? Clearly Europeans had empires, and they're very formal empires. What the United States has in 1945 and into the 50s and 60s is an informal empire. It does not colonize the world except for what it's already taken in various wars like Hawaii and Cuba and Puerto Rico and so forth. But it's an informal empire in the sense that it has no empire, or another way of looking at it is the entire system is its empire. It's an imperial power with a vested interest of maintaining the status quo. Now, this is not to say that the United States is the puppet master of the world. It definitely is not. This is not to say that it's omniscient or an omnipresent force in world affairs. It definitely isn't. It might like to be at various times, but it's not. Nor is this to imply that this is inherently bad, right? There's an assumption that we have because we're trained as, you know, from an early age in our civics class in elementary school, that empires are bad because we broke away from the British Empire. Well, empires are not inherently bad. An imperial power is not inherently bad. You can have a very benevolent empire, and I think I would argue the United States often acts as a benevolent imperial power. One question we can ask is, why is it so interested in promoting and protecting the international system or the status quo? The point of fact is that it benefits us. It benefits us all. And there's very clear ways I can point this out. we have incredibly cheap gasoline in this country. There's a reason for that, right? Because the United States maintains its imperial power. Our coffee is cheap. The beverages we drink are cheap. The clothes on our back are cheap. We live the good life largely because our country is engaged in maintaining an international system, international economic and political system, that allows us to benefit from this. This is the logic, then, that the United States operates in, or has for the last 50 years in terms of its foreign policy, defending the international political and economic system from various threats. Now, we come to another question here. Okay, this is very logical. There's many logics. This definitely is a clear logic. But what are the threats? Where are threats coming from? After 1945, threats were basically defined as the Soviet Union, right? The world communist plot, movement, however you want to define it, and revolutions. Basic revolutions in any country is seen as a possible threat because it's going to disrupt the status quo. Post-1945, the United States becomes very cautious about revolutions, which of course is very ironic given that our country was born of revolutions, though it makes sense. There's a logic going on here. In point of fact, there's a logic of containment. The United States, in order to protect the international political system, at this point in the Cold War, seen as the West, the Western civilization, the Western world, versus the East, the Soviet Union, communism, and various revolutions. It attempts to contain that communist threat and to actively try and dismantle this communist threat. Now, what's the relevance of all I've said so far to Afghanistan? And it's actually quite direct. In 1979, just to go a few years back, and we could go farther back, but I'll pick 1979, the United States government decides to support Afghan rebels. We somewhat know this. They were come out that we've supported the Mujahideen against the Soviet Union. But in point of fact, the Carter administration that is in power in 1979 starts funding Afghan rebels before the Soviets invade. Okay. And National Security Advisor Brzezinski is quite clear about this. The Carter administration is funding Afghan rebels to overthrow the Kabul government. The Kabul government is a pro-Soviet government. The logic the Carter administration has here is to create a situation on the Soviet Union's soft underbelly, if you will, that will draw the Soviet Union, make them commit military forces, economic force, to maintaining their government in Afghanistan. It works. We know this. Soviets invade in 1979. Once they invade in 1979, United States aid becomes less covert and more overt to these rebels. And there's a logic for Carter, right? He's trying to contain Soviet Union. He's trying to destabilize the Soviet Union and protect American national interests as he sees them. And there's a further logic is that when he came into office in 1976, he had certain idealistic expectations of how the Soviet Union was going to work and cooperate. And by 1979, he'd become completely disenfranchised, completely jaded about Soviet Union interests, and he became convinced via National Security Advisor Brzezinski that playing an active destabilizing role against the Soviet Union would help further destabilize the Soviet Union and protect the international political and economic system. Again, there's a logic here. After Carter leaves office, Reagan assumes office, this aid becomes more and more overt. We are aiding Afghan rebels against Soviet occupation of Afghanistan and the government that they are maintaining power in Kabul. These rebels eventually gain power and become elements of the Taliban and Mujahideen, which, of course, we get complicated later on. But there's a certain logic here, right, that we're trying to contain the Soviet Union for the promotion of the political and economic international system against the threat we define. Now, post-1989, Soviet Union collapses. There's no communist threat. So how are we going to define the threat to the international system post-1989? It becomes defined quite clearly as, again, revolutions, because they're disruptive of the status quo, Islamic fundamentalism, and non-U.S. friendly regimes. regimes that we can't kind of manipulate or to make them act the way we'd like them to act. Again, we're not the puppet master, but some regimes are more resistant to our pushing than others. In the region, most clearly, it's Iran, post-Ayatollah Khomeini, Iraq, post the invasion of Kuwait. Beforehand, they were a very valuable ally for the United States. After they invade Kuwait, they become this rouge state. And Afghanistan, because we've basically, the United States has basically helped the Mujahideen overthrow, drive out the Soviets, put them into power, but we can't control them the way we like to. In fact, once the Taliban comes into power in Kabul, driving out what becomes the Northern Alliance, there's definitely a clear break between U.S. desires for how Afghanistan should act and the way that the Taliban regime in Kabul does act. Again, these regimes, they're defined as rouge regimes because they're disruptive politically and economically. The U.S. attempts to increase its leverage over these rouge states because of their disruption through various methods, through the stick, right? Bombing Iraq, establishing a no-fly zone, which basically renders Iraq militarily and to a large extent because of the blockade, economically incapacitated. We use the carrot to try and entice various regimes. About 10 months ago, the George W. Bush administration gave the regime in Kabul, the Taliban, $43 million. It's kind of an incentive, kind of a thank you for the war on drugs as they kind of decimated the opium trade, and kind of hopefully an incentive to have the Taliban play along. So the U.S. has used the carrot, it's used the stick, it's also used a very much of an armed presence, U.S. troops in Saudi Arabia, can reaffirm its commitment to the region, reaffirm its commitment to a number of regimes, regime in Saudi Arabia, regime in Kuwait, regime in Bahrain, which we see as friendly to our national interests because they help us play along with maintain the status quo. Now, again, let me reiterate the point that I'm making here, that the U.S. is an imperial power. We need to recognize this. We might be a democracy at home and value liberty and freedom at home, but we don't act as a democracy abroad. And Henry Kissinger, Charles Schultz, Madeleine Albright are not going to get up here and tell you they have. Right, they'll be quite clear that that's not what they do, and it's not, I think, what we should expect them to do. In fact, we expect, I think most Americans expect the United States to be an imperial power. Even those who are critical of U.S. foreign policy usually want to be more of a benevolent imperial power, however they define benevolence. We'd like to see the U.S. do more in the world, however we define it as being a good power. There's a general acceptance that we are an imperial power without recognizing or put a label on it. We refer to ourselves as the superpower, the hegemon, the world policeman. It's all the same thing, right? What we're really talking about is American imperial power. Well, given that the U.S. is imperial power, there's a couple points I want to make about September 11th and the response to September 11th. I think it's important to recognize that on September 11th, when those four planes attacked the United States in various forms, I think it's important to recognize this as an anti-imperial act of resistance. Right? What was the goal of those terrorists in doing what they did? Now, there's been the point made that this was a war on democracy, an attack on democracy, and I reject that point blank. I don't think the terrorists in those planes really cared if we're a bi-party system, right, or if we have an electoral college, which is kind of screwy and doesn't make sense. And they don't really care about the division between executive and legislature. That's not what they're really interested in. Nor do I believe that they were trying to destroy American military strength. You land a plane in the Pentagon, you're not going to destroy military power. You fly two planes in the World Trade Center, you're not going to destroy the economic power, right? These are symbolic acts. You think about U.S. imperial power, you think of it economic power. What is the symbol of our economy? The World Trade Center. What's the symbol of our military strength? The Pentagon. Now, the fourth plane that crashed over Pennsylvania Where was it going to? It's a pretty good question. I'm willing to put money on it that it was going to be a symbolic target, whether it was the White House or whatever, right? I don't believe for a second that those people piloting those planes into those buildings really thought that they were going to bring the United States to its knees and destroy democracy or whatever. This was a symbolic act. I study Africa, I study the Third World, and this kind of symbolic act fits in with a history of anti-imperial violence, right? This is a symbolic act to show that we do not accept, we are not happy with the status quo, with the international system. We're going to try and make a symbolic act, trying to hurt you as much as possible, but to symbolically show that we're not down with the program, right? So this is how I view September 11th, which is not to say that I accept it, whether I defend it. It was, you know, an evil act, as most violent acts are. But I think that we have to recognize it as an imperial act. And once we do recognize this as an anti-imperial act, the United States is an imperial power and always has been for the last 50 years. We need to recognize then, or we can recognize it, the war right now against Afghanistan is an imperial war. What the United States is doing, and following the logic that it has established for the past 50 years, it makes complete sense, is this is a symbolic reassertion of its imperial power and of its imperial commitment, right? Why go against Afghanistan? None of the people who piloted those planes were Afghani, right? Why bomb 3,700 Afghani citizens, right? And this is actually the numbers that are coming out now. Why not just try and arrest Osama bin Laden and put him on trial, right? This will not do, right? If you're in the logic of U.S. foreign policy, this is not an acceptable option. We have to, once again, reassert our imperial power, show the world, not only the world audience, but our domestic audience, that we're not going to take this, right? That we're going to reassert our imperial power, and we're going to reassert our imperial commitment. We're not going to turn the other cheek because we're not going to be weak, right? To do otherwise would send a message to the world and to our domestic audience that we lack the strength or we lack commitment. Now, I want to make two final points here about this. The first is about the use of terror and terrorism. This is defined as a war against terrorism, which, of course, is a great rhetorical move, but is absolutely not true. If we're declaring a war on terrorism, we're going to have to invade everybody, right? Point of fact is that all states engage in terror. This is a part of international relations and world politics. Whether you're flying a plane into a building or dropping cluster bombs or planting landmines, you're using terror. This is the whole point. You use terror to make your enemy stop doing what you don't want them to do, right? This is the whole point of international relations. Israel uses it, United States uses it, Taliban uses it, we all use it, right? Terror and terrorism is a legitimate tool of international relations. Whether we like it or not, this is a point of fact, is how it goes. And the second point of fact, and this has come up in some conversations, that there's now more Afghani civilians dead from U.S. bombing than, in fact, the World Trade Center bombing, right, if we're counting them, right? And there's been a number of outcries saying that the United States cares less about citizens of foreign countries than it does its own. I can see I've gone well beyond my 20 minutes, so let me just stop there and pass it to the next person.
Thank you, Dr. Don. Our next speaker is Dr. Bill Griffin. Bill Griffin has been a professor in the education department at SUNY Cortland for 47 years. During that time, he has not only distinguished himself in his field, but has also distinguished himself with his political activism. During the Vietnam War, he co-founded Cortland Citizens for Peace, and as a result of his anti-war work, he co-authored the book Lessons of the Vietnam War, A Critical Examination of School Texts. He also ran for New York State Representative to Congress for the first time in 1968. Work in the civil rights movement and environmental movement was also taken on by Dr. Griffin. In 1984, he established the Cortland County Environmental Action Group. In 1990, Dr. Griffin ran again for U.S. Congress. Bill Griffin is the recipient of the Syracuse Peace Council Peace Award, and in 1990, Cortland University's Distinguished Alumni Award for his work in the civil rights and environmental movements. He has written more than 50 articles covering the topics of war, technology, civil rights, and revolution. A participant in numerous demonstrations, he has been arrested 26 times for nonviolent civil disobedience. On a lighter note, he is a jazz drummer and pit musician. He is the father of three grown children and lives with his wife, Judy, in Preble, New York. Dr. Griffin.
I think only one Auburn arrest them. So. Relax.
So far,
yeah. Good. I think after the attack on 9/11, two cliches started to arise and compete with each other. One was we were being urged to return to normalcy, which frequently meant go back to the malls, do some more shopping. high-level advice, or to keep your portfolio moving. We hadn't discovered Enron yet. Keep investing in the market, so that the terrorists wouldn't have won the day. The other cliche, though, which sort of confused one if they were cliche or bumper sticker bound. The other cliche was the world will never be the same. So on the one hand, we were being told to get back to normalcy, and on the other hand, we were told the world will never be the same. So it sort of created a schizophrenic populace right away. I didn't know which bumper sticker to surrender to. So I wanted to try to make some distinctions between what I'm going to call official history, that is, the pronouncements which regularly come out from the government, which are generally, unfortunately, received somewhat uncritically by the most of the media. And after a while, if you repeat those half-truths and those distortions and those lies of omission and commission long enough, they become the official truth. They don't have a real solid relationship with the truth in reality. But they serve to explain, in quotation marks, in the most superficial way, what is happening after 9/11. I want to contrast that with what I think is, if we look to documentation and we strip away the self-serving ideological spins, what would amount to real history. And so I'll dip back in the recent past, as my colleague have, and try to update that. I think the opportunity that we face today is to break, if normalcy is the status quo and the way that we've been doing things for the past 50 years, it presents an opportunity, emotionally anyway, to re-examine that and to join the cliche, things will never be the same, celebrate it, and move on to construct and support something quite different that we are now, I'm going to argue, trapped in. Michael Lerner, a couple of months ago, in an opinion journal, observed the following. He said, "It's not that Americans are willfully deceiving themselves. Most Americans have never, ever heard a serious presentation of our history and our current role in the world." That's what makes this so exciting. This isn't done on any large scale. This isn't done on CNN or MSNBC or the talking heads on Sunday morning. They, back and forth, and make a lot of money on it, they talk about the official history. And they reject as heresy or radicalism anything that departs from that official history line. So in looking at this view of normalcy that we're asked to return to, if we say what has been normal in foreign policy for the past 50 years, it's impossible to escape the fact that what has been normal is violence and the threat of violence, or what would qualify as the definition for terrorism. And as my colleague has said, it's not unusual that nation states and the government follow this strategy. But our country is different in that it's what I call the United States exceptionality. We're the only one that really doesn't do those things, except for the most noble of purposes. And if we ever have visited violence upon anyone or threatened violence to anyone, it was always for some noble cause. We were always extending democracy, liberating people, bringing our way of life. And after you tell that enough times, whether it's in the schools or in political discourse or in the mass media, you start to believe that of all the 140 or so nation states, we're the only one that operates on high-level motives and legitimate, wonderful democratic causes. Well, if you look at the historical record, which is where you'd look for the real history, you'd find the following. This is a partial listing. There are incidents that happen in between here. But just to give you some notion of the exclusiveness of what we have done in terms of violence and threat of violence, if we look at our record of bombing throughout the world, and if we just look since World War II, we see the following real history. It's been recorded and it can be validated. We have bombed in our perceived or our real economic and political interest, China in 1945-46, Korea 50-53, China again in 50-53, Guatemala in 54, Indonesia 1958, Cuba 59-60, Guatemala 1960, Congo 1964, Peru 65, Laos 64-73, Vietnam 61-73, Cambodia 69-70, Nicaragua. Nicaragua is the only instance when a nation state has been internationally accused of terrorism, and it stuck. The World Court said that about our conduct in which tens of thousands were killed in that violent episode in the 1980s. We, because of our power, ignored the verdict and expunged it from our record, so that you never expect to hear that talked about on Firing Line or Meet the Press or any of the other official history programs. Panama in 89, Iraq 91 to the present, the Sudan 1998, Afghanistan 98 to the present, Yugoslavia. In each of those cases, now we talk about noble aims and try to make the connection. Even there, the connection can't be made. In no case, in each of those historical incidents in countries that I mentioned, in no case did a democratic government respectful of human rights occur as a direct result. Through our weapons and our proxies, innocent civilians, however, were the cost. And I skip along and save most of the time for the question and answer. Also, in getting back to normalcy, one of the things that we have to do, instead of describing the lofty ideals which we have, and I celebrate those, at some point in the history, you have to say, how many of those ideals were converted into reality? We say we're working to elevate the human condition. We're working to make people's lives better, more fulfilled. Then you have to go to some record or some quantification of that. And what do you find when you move beyond the ideal pronouncements and you see what is the record of human accomplishments and the satisfaction of human needs in our society, in our nation state, balanced with the rest of the world? And again, here just a smattering of what ought to be concern and what we ought to be hearing on the news every day, but rarely do you. Here is the back to the normalcy in terms of view of economic well-being in the world. In 1900, people in the 10 richest nations earned 9 times as much per capita as the people in the 10 poorest nations. In other words, what is the disparity of wealth on this small planet? By 1960, 60 years later, with a certain kind of system operating, political economy grinds itself out, moving toward globalization. By 1960, the ratio of the top to the bottom was 30-1. In 2000, it was 72-1. The disparity between the obscene poor and the obscene rich is growing. Almost half the people on Earth live on less than $2 a day. The three richest people on earth have wealth that exceeds the combined gross domestic product of the 43rd poorest nations. The CEO salaries, corporate executive offices in the U.S. rose by 571% between 1990 and 2000. We get the tip of the iceberg with this, with the environs, and we see it, and it becomes scandal du jour. You know, it's something that the news media will eat up for a while, and we'll move on. The big story there is this is systemic. They got caught. Everybody is doing this. You just don't shred as well. The workers in that same period, that same decade, the workers increased 5%. That's adjusted for inflation, which that's about what it did, just kept up with inflation. Today's average CEO makes more than $12 million. That's 400 times what a blue-collar worker makes in this country. The wealth of the Forbes 400 richest Americans grew by $1.4 billion each from 1997 to 2000, 3 years. For an average daily increase in wealth of $1,920,000, average daily increase, and the Congress debates about the minimum wage. They say, a dollar? Absurd. How could we ever move $1 million a day? See, we don't get this. This isn't part of official history. It's not part of the official record. That breaks down, incidentally, to for those at the top of the heap, $240,000 per hour. That's 46,602 times the minimum wage. That's the website is Forbes on that. I'm not getting this from the left think tanks. That's a Forbes. That's a Forbes www. You know, so check it out. The people that manage this wealth in this society, the money managers grew the funds that they have from $1.9 trillion in 1980 to $17 trillion in 2000. $17 trillion. The pay gap between the top executives and the production workers in the 362 largest U.S. corporations went from a 42-to-1 ratio in 1980 to a 475-to-1 ratio in 1990. From 1983 to 1977, only the top 5% of U.S. households saw increase in net worth, while the wealth declined for everyone else. Standard of living has gone down recently. These are the effects. These are the results of the system which we are fighting to get back to normal. The financial wealth of the top 1% of U.S. households now exceeds the combined financial wealth of the bottom 95%. Top 1% have more than the bottom 95%. 2 billion people, if we look at the earth, that is one out of three suffer from malnutrition, including 55 million in industrial countries. Just as a footnote to this, while all of this was going on and while we were feeling the legitimate pain of what happened on September 11th, and with all of the chauvinistic jingoism which was buoyed up by our leaders, what were they doing in this context of obscene wealth and poverty? They were passing this massive tax bill in which the political owners of America paid off the corporate partners with a tax bill that gave IBM, General Motors, and General Electric a total of $3.27 billion in immediate tax rebates. And of course, if you're studying Environ, the recent scandal, you'll notice that in the last 4 to 5 years, when the profits were up in the trillions, multi-billions every year, they paid no tax. How many people in this room paid no tax in the last 4 years? That's the system that we're talking about getting back to and that we're defending as the American way of life. I guess the other thing, how close am I?
You've used about not quite 15 minutes.
Oh, okay. The other cliche that we hear is that it is us against them, and that's a very uncomfortable choice for many people, because what us are we talking about? I've named some us's here, which clearly, I haven't even talked about the environment yet. When this money is being made, they have to intervene with Mother Nature. they have to go and dig up some resources, cut down some trees, kill some rainforests. That's what's done when you make these profits. And so that also is part of the package and the normalcy that we're asked to support. I asked the following question when we're looking at economics here. What do the World Bank, the United Nations, and the CIA have in common? Alex Trebek isn't going to ask that, so don't wait too long for that one. But the answer is that in their formal communiques back to each other, if you're willing to read the stuff and not just listen to a soundbite on television, what those three bodies, let me repeat them again, the World Bank, the UN, and the CIA, what they have in common, they both agree in writing that globalization, the back to normalcy that we're fighting to keep moving here, globalization increases worldwide poverty and inequality. That's what we want to change. And that's what's being sold, and that's what we're being deferred by the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks. We have been asked to oversimplify it, that somebody wants to take what we have. That we is a big collective pronoun, isn't it? What we have. We're talking about what the 1%, 5%, 8% at the top have. The World Bank in 1999, in one of their documents, said globalization appears to increase poverty and inequality. The United Nations says this process is concentrating power and marginalizing both the poor, both countries and people. And the CIA said the rising tide of the global economy will create many economic winners, but it will not lift all boats. Globalization's evolution will be rocky, marked by chronic financial volatility and a widening economic divide. And I've already named who does benefit by globalized economic systems. And so there are these messages that are delivered by that we ought to be looking at when we reflect on the world of after 9/11. Actually, the incubation, I think, of terrorism is the miserable living conditions. It would only stand to reason and be logical that as we tended, as conditions were ameliorated for the poor, and particularly in the Southern Hemisphere, there would be less motivation for violence, for individual violence or for institutionalized violence is what we're seeing now. So I guess I'd like to close with the challenge or the messages that I see inherent in here. One is that I would argue and be willing to engage in conversations with people here that 9/11 was a crime. It was a massive crime, but it was not an act of war. And that if we stayed within the legal worldwide community, there are ways to isolate criminals, even those as outrageous and dangerous as the ones that perpetrated the 9/11 crime, to work through international agencies to separate the perpetrators and to bring them to the bar of justice, the World Court, UN auspices, and so on. This then would relieve us of the tremendous attention cost on militarism as the way. Look at the past record of how effective it has been. Militarism is the 20th and 21st century's cul-de-sac. You just never get out of it. Violence begets violence. And one side names it as retaliation, and the other side names it as violence. When are we going to be as concerned over the 600,000-plus Iraqi children whose deaths have been caused? How does that relate to the threat of anthrax to one, two, three, or four politicians and network talking heads? Have some sense of balance there. We are now on a road, and just using the code word of us against them and war against terrorism, on dramatically increasing expenditures on ways to kill people more effectively and losing sight of the need for social justice funding, schools, and for the poor. Let me close with a few very brief quotation from a Dr. Robert Bauman, who he directed the Star Wars program, and he's very outspoken, saying that it never got to the point where it would work. It won't work now, and instead, he has written extensively about how we can be secure. He says we must change our ways. And he offers the following quick list, and I'll close with that. Instead of sending our sons and daughters around the world to kill Arabs so oil companies can sell their oil under their sand, we send them to supply clean water and feed starving children. Instead of continuing to kill thousands of Iraqi children with our sanctions, we help the Iraqis build electric power plants, water treatment facilities, hospitals. If that were happening, what would be the motivation for terrorism? Instead of seeking to be king of the hill, we become responsible members of a family of nations. Instead of stationing hundreds of thousands of troops around the world to protect the financial interests of the multinational corporations, which I just portrayed for you, we bring them home. Instead of supporting military dictatorships, we support true democracy. Reverse what you said is the reality. The reality can be changed. At one time, the reality was slavery. Then we had abolitionists. At one time, the reality was women are second-class citizens. Then we had suffragettes and the struggle for that. So we should never accept that since it is real, since it's happening now, it has to happen for all time. That's why we're here, to make changes. Thank you.